fading and fragmenting into the sea. Half of the globe is illuminated by sunlight, and half is dark. The Terminator, the line between night and day, has just swept across L.A. and is now creeping across the Pacific, off to the west. Everything is going in slow motion. Hiro can see the clouds change shape if he watches them long enough. Looks like a clear night on the East Coast. Something catches his attention moving rapidly over the surface of the globe. He thinks it must be a gnat, but there are no gnats in the metaverse. He tries to focus on it. The computer, bouncing low-powered lasers off his cornea, senses this change in emphasis, and then Hiro gasps as he seems to plunge downward toward the globe, like a spacewalking astronaut who has just fallen out of his orbital groove. When he finally gets it under control, he's just a few hundred miles above the Earth, looking down at a solid bank of clouds, and he can see the gnat gliding along below him. It's a low-flying CIC satellite, swinging north to south in a polar orbit. "Your information, sir," the librarian says. Hiro startles and glances up. Earth swings down and out of his field of view, and there is the librarian standing in front of the desk, holding out a hypercard. Like any librarian in reality, this demon can move around without audible footfalls. "Can you make a little more noise when you walk?" "I'm easily startled," Hiro says. "It is done, sir. My apologies." Hiro reaches out for the hypercard. The librarian takes half a step forward and leans toward him. This time, his foot makes a soft noise on the tatami mat, and Hiro can hear the white noise of his trousers sliding over his leg. Hiro takes the hypercard and looks at it. The front is labeled. Results of library search on Rife. Lawrence Robert, born 1948. He flips the card over. The back is divided into several dozen fingernail-sized icons. Some of them are little snapshots of the front pages of newspapers. Many of them are colorful glowing rectangles, miniature television screens showing live video. "That's impossible," Hiro says. "I'm sitting in a VW van, okay? I'm jacked in over a cellular link. You couldn't have moved that much video into my system that fast." "It was not necessary to move anything," the librarian says. "All existing video on L. Bob Rife was collected by Dr. Lagos and placed in the Babel Infocalypse stack, which you have in your system." Hiro stares at the miniature TV in the upper left corner of the card. It zooms toward him until it's about the size of a 12-inch low-def television set at arm's length. Then the video image begins to play. It's very poor 8mm film footage of a high school football game in the 60s. No soundtrack. "What is this game?" The librarian says,
"Odessa, Texas, 1965. L. Bob Rife is a fullback, number 8 in the dark uniform."
"This is more detail than I need. Can you summarize some of these things?"
"No, but I can list the contents briefly. The stack contains 11 high school football games. Rife was on the second-string Texas All-State team in his senior year. Then he proceeded to Rice on an academic scholarship and walked onto the football team. So there are also 14 tapes of college games. Rife majored in communications."
"Logically enough, considering what he became."
"He became a television sports reporter in the Houston market, so there are 50 hours of footage from this period, mostly outtakes, of course. After 2 years in this line of work, Rife went into business with his great-uncle, a financier with roots in the oil business. The stack contains a few newspaper stories to that effect, which, as I note from reading them, are all textually related, implying that they came from the same source."
"A press release."
"Then there are no stories for 5 years."
"He was up to something."
"Then we begin to see more stories, mostly from the religion sections of Houston newspapers, detailing Rife's contributions to various organizations."
"That sounded like summary to me. I thought you couldn't summarize."
"I can't, really. I was quoting a summary that Dr. Lagos made to Juanita Marquez recently, in my presence, when they were reviewing the same data.
Go on.
Rife contributed $500 to the Highlands Church of the Baptism by Fire. Reverend Wayne Bedford, head minister. $2,500 to the Pentecostal Youth League of Bayside. Reverend Wayne Bedford, president. $150,000 to the Pentecostal Church of the New Trinity. Reverend Wayne Bedford, founder and patriarch. $2.3 million to Rife Bible College. Reverend Wayne Bedford, president and chairman of the theology department. $20 million to the archaeology department of Rife Bible College, plus $45 million to the astronomy department and $100 million to the computer science department.
Did these donations take place before hyperinflation?
Yes, sir. They were, as the expression goes, real money.
That Wayne Bedford guy, is this the same Reverend Wayne who runs the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates?
The same.
Are you telling me that Rife owns the Reverend Wayne?
He owns a majority share in Pearl Gate Associates, which is the multinational that runs the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates chain.
Okay, let's keep sifting through this, Hero says. Hero peeps out over his goggles to confirm that Vitaly is still nowhere near the concert. Then he dives back in and continues to go over the video and the news stories that Lagos has compiled. During the same years that Rife makes his contributions to the Reverend Wayne, he's showing up with increasing frequency in the business section, first in the local papers and later in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. There is a big flurry of publicity, obvious PR plants, after the Nipponese tried to use their old boy network to shut him out of the telecommunications market there. And he took it to the American public, spending $10 million of his own money on a campaign to convince Americans that the Nipponese were duplicitous schemers. A triumphal cover on The Economist after the Nipponese finally knuckled under and let him corner the fiber optics market in that country, and by extension, most of East Asia. Finally, then, the lifestyle pieces start coming in. L. Bob Rife has let his publicists know that he wants to show a more human side. There is a personality journalism program that does a puff piece on Rife after he buys a new yacht, Surplus, from the U.S. government. L. Bob Rife, last of the 19th century monopolists, is shown consulting with his decorator in the captain's quarters. It looks nice as it is, considering that Rife bought this ship from the Navy, but it's not Texan enough for him. He wants it gutted and rebuilt. Then shots of Rife maneuvering his steer-like body through the narrow passages and steep staircase of the ship's interior. Typical boring gray steel Navyscape, which, he assures the interviewer, he is going to have spruced up considerably.
You know, there's a story that when Rockefeller bought himself a yacht, he bought a pretty small one, like a 70-footer or something. Small by the standards of the day. And when someone asked him why he went and bought himself such a dinky little yacht, he just looked at the guy and said, "What do you think I am, a Vanderbilt?" Well, anyway, welcome aboard my yacht.
L. Bob Rife says this while standing on a huge open-air platform elevator, along with the interviewer and the whole camera crew. The elevator is going up. In the background is the Pacific Ocean. As Rife is speaking the last part of the line, suddenly the elevator rises up to the top and the camera turns around, and we are looking out across the deck of the aircraft carrier Enterprise, formerly of the U.S. Navy, now the personal yacht of L. Bob Rife, who beat out both General Jim's defense system and Admiral Bob's global security in a furious bidding war. L. Bob Rife proceeds to admire the vast flat open spaces of the carrier's flight deck, likening it to certain parts of Texas. He suggests that it would be amusing to cover part of it with dirt and raise cattle there. Another profile. This one shot for a business network, apparently made somewhat later. Back on the Enterprise, where the captain's office has been massively reworked, L. Bob Rife,
Lord of Bandwidth, is sitting behind his desk having his mustache waxed. Not in the sense that women have their legs waxed. He's having the curls smoothed out and restored. The waxer is a very short Asian woman who does it so delicately that it doesn't even interfere with his talking, mostly about his efforts to extend his cable TV network throughout Korea and into China, and link it up with his big fiber-optic trunk line that runs across Siberia and over the Urals.
Yeah, you know, a monopolist's work is never done. No such thing as a perfect monopoly. Seems like you can never get that last 0.1%.
Isn't the government still strong in Korea? You must have more trouble with regulations there.
Elbob Reif laughs.
You know, watching government regulators trying to keep up with the world is my favorite sport. Remember when they busted up Ma Bell?
Just barely. The reporter's a woman in her 20s.
You know what it was, right?
Voice communications monopoly.
Right. They were in the same business as me. The information business. Moving phone conversations around on little tiny copper wires one at a time. Government busted them up. At the same time when I was starting cable TV franchises in 30 states. Can you believe that? It's like if they figured out a way to regulate horses at the same time the Model T and the airplane were being introduced.
But a cable TV system isn't the same as a phone system.
At that stage it wasn't, because it was just a local system. But once you get local systems all over the world, all you gotta do is hook them together, and it's a global network. Just as big as the phone system. Except this one carries information 10,000 times faster. It carries images, sound, data, you name it.
A naked PR plant. A half-hour television commercial with no purpose whatsoever other than to let Elbob Reif tell his side of a particular issue. It seems that a number of Reif's programmers, the people who made his systems run, got together and formed a union, unheard of for hackers, and filed a suit against Reif, claiming that he had placed audio and video bugs in their homes. In fact, placed all of them under 24-hour surveillance, and harassed and threatened some programmers who were making what he called unacceptable lifestyle choices. For example, when one of his programmers and her husband engaged in oral sex in their own bedroom one night, the next morning she was called into Reif's office, where he called her a slut and a sodomite and told her to clean out her desk. The bad publicity from this so annoyed Reif that he felt the need to blow a few million on some more PR.
"I deal in information,"
he says to the smarmy, toadying pseudo-journalist who interviews him. He's sitting in his office in Houston looking slicker than normal.
"All television going out to consumers throughout the world goes through me. Most of the information transmitted to and from the CIC database passes through my networks. The metaverse, the entire street, exists by virtue of a network that I own and control. But that means, if you'll just follow my reasoning for a bit, that when I have a programmer working under me who is working with that information, he is wielding enormous power. Information is going into his brain, and it's staying there. It travels with him when he goes home at night. It gets all tangled up into his dreams, for Christ's sake. He talks to his wife about it, and God damn it, he doesn't have any right to that information. If I was running a car factory, I wouldn't let workers drive the cars home or borrow tools. But that's what I do at 5 o'clock each day all over the world when my hackers go home from work. When they used to hang rustlers in the old days, the last thing they would do is piss their pants. That was the ultimate sign, you see, that they had lost control over their own bodies, that they were about to die. See, it's the first function of any organization to control its own sphincters. We're not even doing that. So we're working on refining our management techniques so that we can control that information no matter where it is. On our hard disks,
or even inside the programmers' heads. Now, I can't say more, because I got competition to worry about. But it is my fervent hope that in 5 or 10 years, this kind of thing won't even be an issue. A half-hour episode of a science news program. This one on the controversial new subject of infoastronomy, the search for radio signals coming from other solar systems. L. Bob Reif has taken a personal interest in the subject. As various national governments auction off their possessions, he has purchased a string of radio observatories and hooked them together using his fabled fiber optic net to turn them into a single giant antenna as big as the whole Earth. He is scanning the skies 24 hours a day, looking for radio waves that mean something. Radio waves carrying information from other civilizations. And why, asks the interviewer, a celebrity professor from MIT, why would a simple oilman be interested in such a high-flown abstract pursuit? I just about got this planet all sewn up. Reif delivers this line with an incredibly sardonic and contemptuous twang, the exaggerated accent of a cowboy who suspects that some Yankee pencil neck is looking down his nose at him. Another news piece. This one apparently done a few years later. Again, we are on the Enterprise, but this time the atmosphere is different again. The top deck has been turned into an open-air refugee camp. It is swarming with Bangladeshis that L. Bob Reif plucked out of the Bay of Bengal after their country washed into the ocean in a series of massive floods caused by deforestation farther upstream in India. Hydrological warfare. The camera pans to look out over the edge of the flight deck, and down below, we see the first beginnings of the raft, a relatively small collection of a few hundred boats that have glommed onto the Enterprise, hoping for a free ride across to America. Reif's walking among the people, handing out Bible comics and kisses to little kids. They cluster around with broad smiles, pressing their palms together and bowing. Reif bows back, very awkwardly, but there's no gaiety on his face. He's deadly serious. Mr. Reif, what's your opinion of the people who say you're just doing this as a self-aggrandizing publicity stunt? This interviewer is trying to be more of a bad cop. Shit, if I took time out to have an opinion about everything, I wouldn't get any work done, L. Bob Reif says. You should ask these people what they think. You're telling me that this refugee assistance program has nothing to do with your public image? Nope. Ugh. There's an edit and they cut away to the journalist, pontificating into the camera. Reif was on the verge of delivering a sermon, Hero senses, but they cut him off. But one of the true glories of the library is that it has so many outtakes. Just because a piece of videotape never got edited into a broadcast program doesn't mean it's devoid of intel value. CIC long ago stuck its fingers into the network's videotape libraries. All of those outtakes, millions of hours of footage, have not actually been uploaded to the library in digital form yet. But you can send in a request, and CIC will go and pull that videotape off the shelf for you and play it back. Lagos has already done it. The tape is right there. Nope, look. The raft is a media event, but in a much more profound, general sense than you can possibly imagine. Oh. It's created by the media, in that without the media, people wouldn't know it was here. Refuse wouldn't come out and glom onto it the way they do. And it sustains the media. It creates a lot of information flow, movies, news reports, you know. So you're creating your own news event to make money off of the information flow that it creates? Says the journalist, desperately trying to follow. His tone of voice says that this is all a waste of videotape. His weary attitude suggests that this is not the first time Reif has flown off on a bizarre tangent.
Partly. But that's only a very crude explanation. It really goes a lot deeper than that. You've probably heard the expression that the industry feeds off of biomass, like a whale straining krill from the ocean.
I've heard the expression, yes.
That's my expression. I made it up. An expression like that is just like a virus, you know? It's a piece of information, data that spreads from one person to the next. Well, the function of the raft is to bring more biomass, to renew America. Most countries are static. All they need to do is keep having babies. But America's like this big old clanking, smoking machine that just lumbers across the landscape, scooping up and eating everything in sight. Leaves behind a trail of garbage a mile wide. Always needs more fuel. Ever read the story about the Labyrinth and the Minotaur?
Sure, that was on Crete, right?
The journalist only answers out of sarcasm. He can't believe he's here listening to this. He wants to fly back to L.A. yesterday.
Yeah. Every year, the Greeks had to pony up a few virgins and send them to Crete as tribute. Then the king put them into the Labyrinth, and the Minotaur ate them up. I used to read that story when I was a kid and wonder who the hell these guys were on Crete, that everyone else was so scared of them that they would just meekly give up their children to be eaten every year. They must have been some mean sons of bitches. Now I have a different perspective on it. America must look to those poor little buggers down there, about the same as Crete looked to those poor Greek suckers. Except that there's no coercion involved. Those people down there give up their children willingly, sent them into the Labyrinth by the millions to be eaten up. The industry feeds on them and spits back images, sends out movies and TV programs over my networks, images of wealth and exotic things beyond their wildest dreams, back to those people, and it gives them something to dream about, something to aspire to. And that is the function of the raft. It's just a big old krill carrier.
Finally, the journalist gives up on being a journalist, just starts to slag L. Bob Reif openly. He's had it with this guy.
That's disgusting. I can't believe you can think about people that way.
Shit, boy, get down off your high horse. Nobody really gets eaten. It's just a figure of speech. They come here, they get decent jobs, find Christ, buy a Weber grill, and live happily ever after. What's wrong with that?
Reif is pissed. He's yelling. Behind him, the Bangladeshis are picking up on his emotional vibes and becoming upset themselves. Suddenly, one of them, an incredibly gaunt man with a long, drooping mustache, runs in front of the camera and begins to shout, The sounds spread from him to his neighbors, spreading across the flight deck like a wave.
Cut, the journalist says, turning into the camera. Just cut. The Babel Brigade has started up again.
The soundtrack now consists of 1,000 people speaking in tongues under the high-pitched, shit-eating chuckles of L. Bob Reif.
This is the miracle of tongues, Reif shouts above the tumult. I can understand every word these people are saying. Can you, brother?
Yo, snap out of it, Pod.
Hero looks up from the card. No one is in his office except for the librarian. The image loses focus and veers upward and out of his field of view. Hero is looking out the windshield of the Vanagon. Someone has just yanked his goggles off his face. Not Vitali.
I'm out here, gogglehead.
Hero looks out the window. It's YT, hanging onto the side of the van with one hand, holding his goggles in the other.
You spend too much time goggled in, she says. Try a little reality, man.
Where we are going, Hero says. We're going to get more reality than I can handle.
As Hero and Vitali approach the vast freeway overpass where tonight's concert is to take place, the solid ferrous quality of the Vanagon attracts magnapoons like a Twinkie draws cockroaches. If they knew that Vitali Chernobyl himself was in the van, they'd go crazy. They'd stall the van's engine. But right now, they'll poon anything that might be headed toward the concert. When they get closer to the overpass, it becomes a lost cause trying to drive at all. The thrashers are so thick and numerous. It's like putting on crampons and trying to walk through a room full of puppies. They have to nose their way along, tapping the horn, flashing the lights. Finally, they get to the flatbed semi that constitutes the stage for tonight's concert. Next to it is another semi full of amps and other sound gear. The drivers of the trucks, an oppressed minority of two, have retreated into the cab of the sound truck to smoke cigarettes and glare balefully at the swarm of thrashers, their sworn enemies in the food chain of the highways. They will not voluntarily come out until 5 in the morning, when the way has been made plain. A couple of the other meltdowns are standing around smoking cigarettes, holding them between two fingers in the Slavic style, like darts. They stomp the cigarettes out on the concrete with their cheap vinyl shoes, run up to the van again, and begin to haul out the sound equipment. Vitali puts on goggles, hooks himself into a computer on the sound truck, and begins tuning the system. There's a 3D model of the overpass already in memory. He has to figure out how to sync the delays in all the different speaker clusters to maximize the number of nasty, clashing echoes. Yes. 15. The warm-up band, Blunt Force Trauma, gets rolling at about 9 p.m. On the first power cord, a whole stack of cheap pre-owned speakers shorts out. Its wires throw sparks into the air, sending an arc of chaos through the masked skateboarders. The sound truck's electronics isolate the bad circuit and shut it off before anything or anyone gets hurt. Blunt Force Trauma play a kind of speed reggae, heavily influenced by the anti-technological ideas of the meltdowns. These guys will probably play for an hour, then there will be a couple of hours of Vitali Chernobyl and the meltdowns to look forward to. And if Sushi K shows up, he's welcome to make a guest appearance at the mic. Just in case that actually happens, Hero pulls back from the delirious center of the crowd and begins to orbit back and forth along its fringes. YT's in there somewhere, but no point in trying to track her down. She would be embarrassed anyway to be seen with an oldster like Hero. Now that the concert is up and running, it will take care of itself. There's not much more for Hero to do. Besides, interesting things happen along borders. Transitions. Not in the middle where everything is the same. There may be something happening along the border of the crowd, back where the lights fade into the shade of the overpass. The fringe crowd looks pretty typical for the wrong side of an LA overpass in the middle of the night. There's a good-sized shanty town of hardcore third-world unemployables, plus a scattering of schizophrenic first-worlders who have long ago burned their brains to ash in the radiant heat of their own imaginings. A lot of them have emerged from their overturned dumpsters and refrigerator boxes to stand on tiptoe at the edge of the crowd and peer into the noise and light. Some of them look sleepy and awed, and some, stocky Latino men, look amused by the whole thing, passing cigarettes back and forth and shaking their heads in disbelief. This is Crips turf. The Crips wanted to provide security, but Hero, a student of Altamont, decided to take the risk of snubbing them. He hired the enforcers to do it instead. So every few dozen feet, there's a large man with erect posture wearing an acid green windbreaker with enforcer spelled out across the back. Very conspicuous, which is how they like it. But it's all done with electropigment. So if there's trouble, these guys can turn themselves black by flipping a lapel switch. And they can make themselves bulletproof just by zipping the windbreakers up the front. Right now it's a warm night, and most of them are leaving their uniforms open to the cool breezes. Some of them are just coasting, but most of them are attentive, keeping their eyes on the crowd, not the band. Seeing all of those soldiers, Hero looks for the general and soon finds him. A small, stout black guy, a pint-sized weightlifter type. He's wearing the same windbreaker as the others, but there's an additional layer of bulletproof vest underneath. And clipped onto that, he's got a nice assortment of communications gear and small, clever devices for hurting people. He's doing a lot of jogging back and forth, swiveling his head from side to side, mumbling quick bursts into his headset like a football coach on the sidelines. Hero notices a tall man in his late 30s, distinguished goatee, wearing a very nice charcoal gray suit. Hero can see the diamonds in his tie pin flashing from 100 feet away. He knows that if he gets up closer, he will be able to see the word Crips spelled out in blue sapphires, nestled among those diamonds. He's got his own security detail of half a dozen other guys in suits. Even though they aren't doing security, they couldn't help sending along a token delegation to show the colors. This is a non sequitur that has been nibbling on the edges of Hero's mind for the last 10 minutes. Laser light has a particular kind of gritty intensity, a molecular purity reflecting its origins. Your eye notices this, somehow knows that it's unnatural. It stands out anywhere, but especially under a dirty overpass in the middle of the night. Hero keeps getting flashes of it in his peripheral vision, keeps glancing over to track down its source. It's obvious to him, but no one else seems to notice. Someone in this overpass, somewhere, is bouncing a laser beam off Hero's face. It's annoying. Without being too obvious about it, he changes his course slightly, wanders over to a point downwind of a trash fire that's burning in a steel drum. Now he's standing in the middle of a plume of diluted smoke that he can smell but can't quite see. But the next time the laser darts into his face, it scatters off a million tiny ashy particulates and reveals itself as a pure geometric line in space pointing straight back to its source. It's a gargoyle, standing in the dimness next to a shanty. Just in case he's not already conspicuous enough, he's wearing a suit. Hero starts walking toward him. Gargoyles represent the embarrassing side of the Central Intelligence Corporation. Instead of using laptops, they wear the computers on their bodies, broken up into separate modules that hang on the waist, on the back, on the headset. They serve as human surveillance devices, recording everything that happens around them. Nothing looks stupider. These get-ups are the modern-day equivalent of the slide rule scabbard or the calculator pouch in the belt, marking the user as belonging to a class that is at once above and far below human society. They are a boon to Hero because they embody the worst stereotype of the CIC stringer. They draw all of the attention. The payoff for this self-imposed ostracism is that you can be in the metaverse all the time and gather intelligence all the time. The CIC brass can't stand these guys because they upload staggering quantities of useless information to the database on the off chance that some of it will eventually be useful. It's like writing down the license number of every car you see on your way to work each morning, just in case one of them will be involved in a hit-and-run accident. Even the CIC database can only hold so much garbage. So usually these habitual gargoyles get kicked out of CIC before too long. This guy hasn't been kicked out yet. And to judge from the quality of his equipment, which is very expensive, he's been at it for a while. So he must be pretty good. If so, what's he doing hanging around this place? Hero protagonist, the gargoyle says, as Hero finally tracks him down in the darkness beside a shanty. CIC stringer for 11 months, specializing in the industry. Former hacker, security guard, pizza deliverer, concert promoter. He sort of mumbles it, not wanting Hero to waste his time reciting a bunch of known facts. The laser that kept jabbing Hero in the eye was shot out of this guy's computer from a peripheral device that sits above his goggles in the middle of his forehead. A long-range retinal scanner. If you turn toward him with your eyes open, the laser shoots out, penetrates your iris, tenderest of sphincters, and scans your retina. The results are shot back to CIC, which has a database of several tens of millions of scanned retinas.
Within a few seconds, if you're in the database already, the owner finds out who you are. If you're not already in the database, well, you are now. Of course, the user has to have access privileges. And once he gets your identity, he has to have more access privileges to find out personal information about you. This guy apparently has a lot of access privileges, a lot more than Hero. Name's Lagos, the gargoyle says. So, this is the guy. Hero considers asking him what the hell he's doing here. He'd love to take him out for a drink, talk to him about how the librarian was coded. But he's pissed off. Lagos is being rude to him. Gargoyles are rude by definition. You hearing the Raven thing? Or just that Fuzzgrunge tip you've been working on for the last 36 days approximately, Lagos says. Gargoyles are no fun to talk to. They never finish a sentence. They are adrift in a laser-drawn world, scanning retinas in all directions, doing background checks on everyone within 1,000 yards, seeing everything in visual light, infrared, millimeter wave radar, and ultrasound all at once. You think they're talking to you, but they're actually poring over the credit record of some stranger on the other side of the room, or identifying the make and model of airplanes flying overhead. For all he knows, Lagos is standing there, measuring the length of Hero's cock through his trousers while they pretend to make conversation. You're the guy who's working with Juanita, right? Hero says. Or she's working with me, or something like that. She said she wanted me to meet you. For several seconds, Lagos is frozen. He's ransacking more data. Hero wants to throw a bucket of water on him. Makes sense, he says. You're as familiar with the metaverse as anyone. Freelance hacker, that's exactly right. Exactly right for what? Hero says. No one wants freelance hackers anymore. The corporate assembly line hackers are suckers for infection. They're going to go down by the thousands, just like Sennacherib's army before the walls of Jerusalem, Lagos says. Infection? Sennacherib. And you can defend yourself in reality, too. That'll be good if you ever go up against Raven. Remember, his knives are as sharp as a molecule. They'll go through a bulletproof jacket like lingerie. Raven. You'll probably see him tonight. Don't mess with him. Okay, Hero says. I'll look out for him. That's not what I said, Lagos said. I said don't mess with him. Why not? It's a dangerous world, Lagos says. Getting more dangerous all the time. So we don't want to upset the balance of terror. Just think about the Cold War.
Yep.
All Hero wants to do now is walk away and never see this guy again. But he won't wind up the conversation. You're a hacker. That means you have deep structures to worry about, too.
Deep structures?
Neurolinguistic pathways in your brain. Remember the first time you learned binary code?
Sure.
You were forming pathways in your brain, deep structures. Your nerves grow new connections as you use them. The axons split and push their way between the dividing glial cells. Your BioWare self-modifies. The software becomes part of the hardware. So now you're vulnerable. All hackers are vulnerable to a NAMSHUB. We have to look out for each other.
What's a NAMSHUB? Why am I vulnerable to it? Hero asks.
Just don't stare into any bitmaps. Anyone try to show you a raw bitmap lately? Like in the metaverse?
Interesting. Not to me personally, but now that you mention it, this Brandy came up to my friend.
A cult prostitute of Asherah. Trying to spread the disease, which is synonymous with evil. Sound melodramatic? Not really. You know, to the Mesopotamians, there was no independent concept of evil. Just disease and ill health. Evil was a synonym for disease. So what does that tell you?
Hero walks away, the same way he walks away from psychotic street people who follow him down the street.
It tells you that evil is a virus, Lagos calls after him. Don't let the NAMSHUB into your operating system.
Juanita's working with this alien?
Blunt force trauma play for a solid hour. segueing from one song into the next with no chink or crevice in the wall of noise. All a part of the aesthetic. When the music stops, their set is over. For the first time, Hiro can hear the exaltation of the crowd. It's a blast of high-pitched noise that he feels in his head ringing his ears. But there's a low thudding sound, too, like someone pummeling a bass drum, and for a minute, he thinks maybe it's a truck rolling by on the overpass above them. But it's too steady for that. It doesn't die away. It's behind him. Other people have noticed it, turned to look toward the sound, are scurrying out of the way. Hiro sidesteps, turning to see what it is. Big and black to begin with. It does not seem as though such a large man could perch on a motorcycle, even a big chortling Harley like this one. Correction. It's a Harley with some kind of a sidecar added. A sleek black projectile hanging off to the right, supported on its own wheel. But no one is sitting in the sidecar. It does not seem as though a man could be this bulky without being fat. But he's not fat at all. He's wearing tight, stretchy clothes, like leather but not quite, that show bones and muscles but nothing else. He is riding the Harley so slowly that he would certainly fall over if not for the sidecar. Occasionally, he gooses it forward with a flick of the fingers on his clutch hand. Maybe one reason he looks so big, other than the fact that he really is big, is the fact that he appears totally neckless. His head starts out wide and just keeps getting wider until it merges with his shoulders. At first, Hiro thinks it must be some kind of avant-garde helmet. But when the man rolls past him, this great shroud moves and flutters, and Hiro sees that it is just his hair, a thick mane of black hair tossed back over his shoulders, trailing down his back almost to his waist. As he is marveling at this, he realizes that the man has turned his head to look back at him, or to look in his general direction anyway. It's impossible to tell exactly what he's looking at because of his goggles. A smooth convex shell over the eyes, interrupted by a narrow horizontal slit. He is looking at Hiro. He gives him the same fuck-you smile that he sported earlier tonight, when Hiro was standing in the entryway to the Black Sun, and he was in a public terminal somewhere. This is the guy. Raven. This is the guy that Juanita's looking for. The guy Lagos told him not to mess with. And Hiro has seen him before, outside the entrance to the Black Sun. This is the guy who gave the snow crash card to David. The tattoo on his forehead consists of three words written in block letters. Poor impulse control. Hiro startles and actually jumps into the air as Vitali Chernobyl and the Meltdowns launch into their opening number, Radiation Burn. It is a tornado of mostly high-pitched noise and distortion, like being flung bodily through a wall of fishhooks. These days, most states are franchelets or burbclaves, much too small to have anything like a jail or even a judicial system. So when someone does something bad, they try to find quick and dirty punishments like flogging, confiscation of property, public humiliation, or in the case of people who have a high potential of going on to hurt others, a warning tattoo on a prominent body part. Poor impulse control. Apparently, this guy went to such a place and lost his temper real bad. For an instant, a glowing red gridwork is plotted against the side of Raven's face. It rapidly shrinks, all sides converging inward toward the right pupil. Raven shakes his head, turns to look for the source of the laser light, but it's already gone. Lagos has already got his retinal scan. That's why Lagos is here. He's not interested in Hiro or Vitali Chernobyl. He's interested in Raven. And somehow Lagos knew that he was going to be here. And Lagos is somewhere nearby right now, videotaping the guy, probing the contents of his pockets with radar, recording his pulse and respiration. Hiro picks up his personal phone. YT, he says, and it dials YT's number. It rings for a long time before she picks it up. It's almost impossible to hear anything over the sound of the concert.
What the fuck do you want?
YT, I'm sorry about this, but something's going on.
something big time. I'm keeping one eye on a big biker named Raven.
The problem with you hackers is you never stop working.
That's what a hacker is, Hero says.
I'll keep an eye on this Raven guy too, she says. Sometime when I am working.
Then she hangs up. Raven makes a couple of broad, lazy sweeps along the perimeter of the crowd, going very slowly, looking in all directions. He is annoyingly calm and unhurried. Then he cuts farther out into the darkness, away from the crowd. He does a little more looking around, checking out the perimeter of the shantytown. And finally, he swings the big Harley around in a trajectory that brings him back to the big important Crip, the guy with the sapphire tie clip and the personal security detail. Hero begins weaving through the crowd in that direction, trying not to be too obvious about it. This looks like it's going to be interesting. As Raven approaches, the bodyguards converge on the head Crip, form a loose protective ring around him. As he comes nearer, all of them back away a step or two, as though the man is surrounded by an invisible force field. He finally comes to a stop, deigns to put his feet on the ground. He flicks a few switches on the handlebars before he steps away from his Harley. Then, anticipating what's next, he stands with his feet apart and his arms up. One Crip approaches from each side. They don't look real happy about this particular duty. They keep casting sidelong glances at the motorcycle. The head Crip keeps goading them forward with his voice, shooing them toward Raven with his hands. Each one of them has a handheld metal-detecting wand. They swirl the wands around his body and find nothing at all, not even the tiniest speck of metal, not even coins in his pocket. The man is 100% organic. So if nothing else, Lagos's warning about Raven's knife has turned out to be bullshit. These two Crips walk rapidly back to the main group. Raven begins to follow them, but the head Crip takes a step back, holds both of his hands up in a stop motion. Raven stops, stands there, the grin returning to his face. The head Crip turns away and gestures back toward his black BMW. The rear door of the BMW opens up and a man gets out. A younger, smaller black man in round wire rims, wearing jeans and big white athletic shoes and typical studentish gear. The student walks slowly toward Raven, pulling something from his pocket. It's a handheld device, but much too bulky to be a calculator. It's got a keypad on the top and a sort of window on one end, which the student keeps aiming toward Raven. There's an LED readout above the keypad and a red flashing light underneath that. The student is wearing a pair of headphones that are jacked into a socket on the butt of the device. For starters, the student aims the window at the ground, then at the sky, then at Raven, keeping his eye on the flashing red light and the LED readout. It has the feel of some kind of religious rite, accepting digital input from the sky spirit, and then the ground spirit, and then from the black biker angel. Then he begins to walk slowly toward Raven, one step at a time. Hero can see the red light flashing intermittently, not following any particular pattern or rhythm. The student gets to within a yard of Raven and then orbits him a couple of times, always keeping the device aimed inward. When he's finished, he steps back briskly, turns and aims it toward the motorcycle. When the device is aimed at the motorcycle, the red light flashes much more quickly. The student walks up to the head Crip, pulling off his headphones, and has a short conversation with him. The Crip listens to the student but keeps his eyes fixed on Raven, nods his head a few times, finally pats the student on his shoulder and sends him back to the BMW. It was a Geiger counter. Raven strolls up to the big Crip. They shake hands, a standard plain old Euro shake, no fancy variations. It's not a real friendly get-together. The Crip has his eyes a little too wide open. Hero can see the furrows in his brow, everything about his posture and his face screaming out,
Get me away from this Martian. Raven goes back to his radioactive hog, releases a few bungee cords, and picks up a metal briefcase. He hands it to the head Crip, and they shake hands again. Then he turns away, walks slowly and calmly back to the motorcycle, gets on, and putt-putts away. Hero would love to stick around and watch some more, but he has the feeling that Lagos has this particular event covered. And besides, he has other business. Two limousines are fighting their way through the crowd, headed for the stage. The limousines stop, and Nipponese people start to climb out. Dark-clad, unfunky, they stand around awkwardly in the middle of the party-slash-riot, like a handful of broken nails suspended in a colorful jello mold. Finally, Hero makes bold enough to go up and look into one of the windows to find out if this is who he thinks it is. Can't see through the smoke glass. He bends down, puts his face right near the window, trying to make it real obvious. Still no response. Finally, he knocks on the window. Silence. He looks up at the entourage. They are all watching him. But when he looks up, they glance away, suddenly remember to drag on their cigarettes or rub their eyebrows. There is only one source of light inside the limousine that's bright enough to be visible through the smoke glass, and that is the distinctive inflated rectangle of a television screen. What the hell? This is America. Hero is half American, and there's no reason to take this politeness thing to an unhealthy extreme. He hauls the door open and looks into the back of the limousine. Sushi K is sitting there, wedged in between a couple of other young Nipponese men, programmers on his imageering team. His hairdo is turned off, so it just looks like an orange afro. He is wearing a partly assembled stage costume, apparently expecting to be performing tonight. Looks like he's taking Hero up on his offer. He's watching a well-known television program called I Spy, spelled E-Y-E, Spy. It is produced by CIC and syndicated through one of the major studios. It is reality television. CIC picks out one of their agents who was involved in a wet operation, doing some actual cloak and dagger work, and has him put on a gargoyle rig so that everything he sees and hears is transmitted back to the home base in Langley. This material is then edited into a weekly hour-long program. Hero never watches it. Now that he works for CIC, he finds it kind of annoying. But he hears a lot of gossip about the show, and he knows that tonight they are showing the second-to-last episode in a 5-part arc. CIC has smuggled a guy onto the raft, where he is trying to infiltrate one of its many colorful and sadistic pirate bands, the Bruce Lee Organization. Hero enters the limousine and gets a look at the TV just in time to see Bruce Lee himself, as seen from the point of view of the hapless gargoyle spy, approaching down some dank corridor on a raft ghost ship. Condensation is dripping from the blade of Bruce Lee's samurai sword.
"Bruce Lee's men have trapped this spy in an old Korean factory ship in the core,"
one of Sushi K's henchmen says, a rapid hissing explanation.
"They are looking for him now."
Suddenly, Bruce Lee is pinioned under a brilliant spotlight that makes his trademark diamond grin flash like the arm of a galaxy. In the middle of the screen, a pair of crosshairs swing into place, centered on Bruce Lee's forehead. Apparently, the spy has decided he must fight his way out of this mess and is bringing some powerful CIC weapon system to bear on Bruce Lee's skull. But then a blur comes in from the side, a mysterious dark shape blocking our view of Bruce Lee. The crosshairs are now centered on what exactly? We'll have to wait until next week to find out. Hero sits down across from Sushi K and the programmers, next to the television set, so that he can get a TV's eye view of the man.
"I'm Hero Protagonist. You got my message, I take it."
"Fabu!"
Sushi K cries, using the Nipponese abbreviation of the all-purpose Hollywood adjective, fabulous. He continues,
"Hiro-san, I am deeply indebted to you for this once-in-a-lifetime chance to perform my small works before such an audience."
He says the whole thing in Nipponese, except for once-in-a-lifetime chance.
"I must humbly apologize for arranging the whole thing so hastily and haphazardly," Hiro says.
It pains me deeply that you should feel the need to apologize when you have given me an opportunity that any Nipponese rapper would give anything for, to perform my humble works before actual homeboys from the ghettos of L.A.
I'm profoundly embarrassed to reveal that these fans are not exactly ghetto homeboys, as I must have carelessly led you to believe. They're thrashers, skateboarders who like both rap music and heavy metal.
Ah, this is fine then,
Sushike says, but his tone of voice suggests that it's not really fine at all. But there are representatives of the Crips here, Hiro says, thinking very, very fast even by his standards. And if your performance is well received, as I'm quite certain it will be, they will spread the word throughout their community. Sushike rolls down the window. The decibel level quintuples in an instant. He stares at the crowd, 5,000 potential market shares, young people with funkiness on their minds. They've never heard any music before that wasn't perfect. It's either studio-perfect digital sound from their CD players, or performance-perfect fuzz grunge from the best people in the business, the groups that have come to L.A. to make a name for themselves and have actually survived the gladiatorial combat environment of the clubs. Sushike's face lights up with a combination of joy and terror. Now he actually has to go up there and do it, in front of the seething biomass. Hiro goes out and paves the way for him. That's easy enough. Then he bails. He's done his bit. No point in wasting time on this puny Sushike thing when Raven is out there, representing a much larger source of income. So he wanders back out toward the periphery.
Yo! Dude with the swords, someone says.
Hiro turns around, sees a green-jacketed enforcer motioning to him. It's the short, powerful guy with the headset, the guy in charge of the security detail.
Squeaky, he says, extending his hand. Hiro,
Hiro says, shaking it and handing over his business card. No particular reason to be coy with these guys.
What can I do for you, Squeaky?
Squeaky reads the card. He has a kind of exaggerated politeness that is kind of like a military man. He's calm, mature, role model-esque, like a high school football coach.
You in charge of this thing?
To the extent anyone is.
Mr. Protagonist, we got a call a few minutes ago from a friend of yours named YT.
What's wrong? Is she okay?
Oh, yes, sir. She's just fine. But you know that bug you were talking to earlier?
Hero's never heard the term bug used this way, but he reckons that Squeaky is referring to the gargoyle, Lagos.
Yeah?
Well, there's a situation involving that gentleman that YT sort of tipped us off to. We thought you might want to have a look.
What's going on?
Why don't you come with me? You know, some things are easier to show than to explain verbally.
As Squeaky turns, Sushike's first rap song begins. His voice sounds tight and tense.
I'm Sushike, and I'm here to say, I like to rap in a different way. Look out number one in every city. Sushike rap has almost pretty. My special talking of remarkable words is not the stereotype bucktooth nerd. My hair is big as a galaxy, cause I attain greater technology.
Hiro follows Squeaky away from the crowd into the dimly lit area on the edge of the shantytown. Up above them on the overpass embankment, he can dimly make out phosphorescent shapes, green-jacketed enforcers orbiting some strange attractor. Watch your step, Squeaky says as they begin to climb up the embankment. It's slippery in places.
I like to rap about sweet and romance. My fond ambition is of your pants. So here is of special remarkable way of this fellow raps named Sushike. The Nipponese talking phenomenon like samurai sword, his sharpened tongue, who raps the East Asia and the Pacific, prosperity sphere to be specific.
It's a typical loose slope of dirt and stones that looks like it would wash away in the first rainfall. Sage and cactus and tumbleweeds here and there, all looking scraggly and half-dead from air pollution. It's hard to see anything clearly because Sushike is jumping around down below them on the stage,
The brilliant orange rays of his sunburst hairdo are sweeping back and forth across the embankment at a speed that seems to be supersonic, washing grainy, gritty light over the weeds and the rocks and throwing everything into weird, discolored, high-contrast freeze frames.
Sarari man on subway listen for sushi K like nuclear fission. Fire-breathing lizard, goji roar. He my always big-time hero. His mutant rap bummed down whole